When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Wait, wait, wait. Before we start, just want to make sure we're clear here. While this podcast talks about sobriety, mental health, and addiction, it is not meant to replace professional medical advice. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're ex-sisters-in-law, brought together in marriage and bonded through our sobriety journey.
Join us as we talk sobriety, addiction, and everything in between. You're in for quite a ride. And our Substack is buzzing with amazing content, from creative mocktail recipes to insightful courses and reflective exercises. There is something for everyone. Don't miss out. It's a great way to add some extra joy and depth to your journey. Check it out. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety. Today, we have the pleasure of having our guest here for the second time. Erin Gilmore is an incredible psychotherapist and founder of Rose Psychotherapy. And in our last episode, we talked about IFS or parts therapy, and we didn't even get to all our questions.
We didn't. So we definitely had to have Erin back. Erin has extensive experience working with individuals struggling with substance use disorders and co-occurring mental health conditions. Her approach is deeply rooted in empathy and evidence-based practices, and she aims to guide her clients towards healing and long-term recovery.
So in today's conversation, we'll be diving into the complexities of co-occurring disorders, how they manifest, the challenges they present, and the best practices for treating them. Erin's insights will help us understand the intricate relationship between mental health and substance use, and how we can better support those on their journey to recovery. So Erin, can you tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to specialize in treating co-occurring disorders?
Sure. Yeah. First of all, thank you for having me back. It was such a blast the first time, and I'm just so happy and honored and privileged to be invited back. I think it's great work you guys do, and happy to participate in any way that I can. So co-occurring disorders essentially means kind of a substance use disorder alongside, or diagnosed alongside, with a mental health issue. And it's, the question is, how did you get into treating that or specialize in that? And the answer is truly out of necessity, right? So it's it's not anything that I sought specifically in my education and training. It is now definitely a part of all education and training for substance use counselors and registered psychotherapists. And the reason is because it is so common, and it is difficult to find someone who has a substance use disorder that doesn't have a co-occurring mental health issue as well. So the first kind of experience that I had was working in the field, is working in a residential or a live-in treatment center for women. And the co-occurring issues of anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, neurodivergence, ADHD, etc., were in the majority of our clients, right? So the treatment became very necessary to train and to practice treating co-occurring disorders, because it's difficult, especially in the treatment setting, to find someone with kind of just a substance use disorder without co-occurring disorder. So what we find in a lot of the population, especially treatment seeking population, is that they will be dealing with the complexity of a mental health issue alongside a substance use disorder.
That's interesting. So how do you identify and diagnose co-occurring disorders in your practice?
So in my private practice, it's doing a lot of history taking, a lot of listening to the client, listening to their experience, specifically in terms of, so if a client comes and says, I'd like to work on my substance use disorder, there is a lot of context to that. They don't develop out of nowhere. They don't fall out of the sky. And in very rare cases, is it kind of recreational use that turns into a severe substance use disorder. There is usually a deeper context of using substances to cope with pre-existing difficulties, whether it be anxiety or a traumatic experience, symptoms of depression. So we'll often find that. So when I work with clients, it's doing a lot of history taking of why did the substance you start? When did it become problematic? What was going on for you before that? And really trying to identify symptoms of what may have been occurring before. And also, once the substance you started, what new symptoms arose then? Because as we know, it's bi-directional. So sometimes the mental health issue, anxiety or depression, comes first, and substances are there to cope with those symptoms. And sometimes the substance use starts and creates some of the symptoms of anxiety or depression or another mental health issue. So it's really taking that in-depth history, listening to the client. They know their experience. They know how they felt before, during, and after using substances. And mostly they know why. So I would say the majority of my clients say, I have this pain, whatever kind of symptom is showing up and creating pain, you know, grief, loss, symptoms of depression. I have this pain and these substances help me cope with that pain. It's also important to try as best as possible. It can get complex sometimes to see what's there when the substance use isn't there. So if there has been a period of abstinence or a period of sobriety, is in a little while, because the first couple weeks are difficult after stopping using or changing use. After a little while, is anxiety increased or is it better? Are symptoms of depression more prevalent when you're not using, or are they relieved? And that kind of helps tease out a little bit of what might be contributing. In terms of diagnosis, as a psychotherapist, I don't diagnose, but we would go through some of the screeners. We would talk at length about what's your experience like. And most of my clients will show up with a diagnosis already given by a family doctor or a psychiatrist. So they'll know, like, yes, I have co-occurring mental health issues.
So you've named some of the challenges already, like in a sense of treating a client that has substance use disorder and a co-occurring condition. But what are some of the challenges for you when you're treating those clients?
Yeah, it's more complex, right? There's some mm-hmm. different layers, and I don't want to pathologize it, because truly, I mean, if you look at the research, I think the research says it's very hard to figure out in studies, but I think the research says anywhere between 20 and 80%, or to kind of ballpark it more, about a third of people will have concurrent disorders. So it's quite frequent, right? And in my own experience, anecdotally, almost everybody that I've worked with the substance use issue has a concurrent mental health issue. So I don't want to pathologize it. It's not, it doesn't mean recovery can't happen. It doesn't mean that it's a long and arduous journey any more so than a kind of recovery just from substance use would be. But it is more complex, right? So a person navigating triggers, navigating a recovery plan, navigating urges, cravings, and desires to engage in substance use, that's hard enough. But navigating that within a context of a major depressive episode or panic mm-hmm. attacks or traumatic flashbacks, it's more complex. There's more tools that are needed. There's more safety and stabilization as a forefront of the therapeutic process, and really building up those skills and tools. I find psychoeducation goes a really long way, right? So often, and I'm sure you guys have experienced this with clients, is they come in and say, I have all these problems and it's because something's wrong with me. But the psychoeducation piece of, actually, you have substance use disorder and that's what this looks like, and you also, sounds like you have anxiety or panic disorder and that's what that looks like, and it's not because something is fundamentally flawed with you, they're just two different disorders at the same time. And it does make it harder on some days for some people. I think another challenge as a psychotherapist is being able to identify if there's different treatment needed for the different things. So the research shows that concurrent treatment works best for concurrent disorders, right? But there are times where one does take precedence.
Can you give an example of that?
Sure. So Yeah, if there's a person who is struggling with a mood disorder and is using a substance every day to the point of intoxication, it's really hard to make headway in navigating that mood disorder or stabilizing mood and learning coping skills and strategies if the person's intoxicated every day, or if they're in and out of the emergency room because of overuse, or if they're I don't work with many of these people in my private practice, but I certainly did prior to this. If they're unhoused or in unsafe situations, certain things take priority for a time.
I remember when I was doing my practicum, I did it at a hospice. And it was there was various types of clients that I used to see from all different walks of life. And grief obviously was there because I was seeing a lot of people who had lost loved ones. And if there was a substance use disorder, sometimes I would have clients come in intoxicated. And there's definitely an ethical piece around that, but I couldn't do any sort of treatment, but I would hold space, right? Hold space, make sure the person was safe. Like there's sometimes priorities just shift. Like I'm not going to be dealing with grief in that moment, in a sense, like treating it specifically, but holding space.
Yeah, exactly. And you work with what's in front of you. I can have all the treatment plans and research and evidence-based tools at my ready, but the person who's in front of me in session is dictates what we do based on what they need in that moment. And sometimes it is the holding space. I think some of the complexity too is for people who have, I'm thinking in this case primarily because this is the population I work most with, but women who things are very functional in their lives. Mothers, people who are women who are working, really on the outside, things look functional. But the experience of anxiety, a truly kind of clinical level anxiety disorder, has been with them for so many years. It becomes a part how they think they are, who they think they are, part of their personality. And that alcohol or the whatever substance, fill in the blank, becomes such an important part of coping and functioning. That's complex too, right? Like sometimes a functional life can be built around something that is harmful or becomes harmful over time, like a substance use disorder, and that's the only coping skill that's been developed over time to deal with some mental health issue that's been there for a very long time. So sometimes it's a longer process, and it's relearning and developing new ways of existing while also managing the symptoms of a mental health issue.
It's so interesting, Erin, when I started researching this episode, in my mind, co-occurring disorders were like a porn addiction. Like you have an alcohol problem and a porn addiction. You have this issue and like, yeah, eating disorder. And when you start to work on the substance use, the other one kind of has room to proliferate. So I didn't associate anxiety, depression, which I have both as co-occurring disorders. So it's really, now I realize I have co-occurring disorders.
So join the club.
So I have anxiety. And so how does that manifest in somebody who's struggling with substance use? And is it different if I hadn't struggled with substance use disorder?
So great question. Anxiety disorders are kind of the most prevalent mental health issue. And in fact, I would say like so common that most of the population, or at least the people I see and talk to and hear about, have some form of anxiety disorder. And the experience of having an anxiety disorder is an experience of constant activation and feeling of threat or unsafety within the body and within the mind, right? Cognitive processes. And so for me, in my experience and just my viewpoint, it makes absolute perfect sense that a person who constantly feels activated or that a threat is coming would find comfort and some sort of relief in a substance that dampens or numbs some of that intense discomfort, right? So it makes perfect sense to me that alcohol or another substance would come in as a bit of a savior in the beginning with for someone who has an anxiety disorder. The problem with that is that substances never continue performing as they initially do, and they eventually start creating their own issues. The other problem in the framework of anxiety is that, so safety behaviors, things that kind of steer us away from confronting or working through the anxiety and make us feel better in the moment, unfortunately, paradoxically, do increase anxiety over time. So what initially serves as a solution, so a couple glasses of wine at night or whatever that looks like to bring the system down a little bit in terms of activation, will eventually lead to higher levels of anxiety in the long run. Not to mention like the hangxiety that comes like after the day after it. And so it's a bit of a lie that it tells us is that using these substances is helping my anxiety when in the long term it's actually increasing it and decreasing our capacity and space to develop other coping strategies. So a short summary answer is that using substances actually can increase how anxiety shows up for a person and make it more difficult and solidify some of those anxiety patterns cognitively to make it even more intractable or difficult to cope with and
I
live with.
definitely felt that in my experience, Sonia. I think you did too. Like anxiety would be my substance of choice was not alcohol necessarily, but I could my anxiety went way up whenever I drank. And you too, right, Sonia?
Are you looking to reset your relationship with alcohol? Look no further than our self-paced 7-day reset program. In just 1 week, you'll gain the tools and support you need to kickstart your journey to a healthier, more balanced lifestyle. Our program includes daily audio, helpful exercises, and guided reflections. And best of all, it's on your time. Head over to sistersinsobriety.substack.com and let's take that first step together towards a better you. Yeah, it's a weird idea, right? Because I was self-medicating the anxiety with alcohol. And so the only part I would say that was harder when I quit drinking was that sort of getting used to feeling that initial like 10, 20 minutes of anxiety without running to a drink. And then once I could get through that, all of a sudden it was better. Oh, let me think clearly on how to deal with this instead of I would drink and then either forget about it or come up with this fantastical solution to my anxiety. They're like, wait, I think the issue is, and I would come up with some bizarre solution. So the self-medicating, it's so temporary, and that's what I noticed when I quit drinking.
It is, and it's like digging a hole. Like every time we think, okay, I'm gonna have the drinks, or I'm gonna do the thing, or I'm gonna engage in the behavior. Same is very true of eating disorders, which weirdly I didn't mention because that's my other kind of area of focus in my practice. But it's like the behavior is going to make me feel better right now, but it actually just kind of digs the hole a little bit deeper. And then to your earlier point with the question of a person without a substance use disorder, anxiety is also incredibly difficult and painful for that person, and they may experience the same kind of difficulties of what anxiety shows up as and the discomfort of that. They may have more opportunities to develop other coping skills or healthier coping skills to cope with those panic attacks or moments of anxiety if they're not using a substance.
So, how do you address the relationship between anxiety and substance use in therapy? Is it a lot of psychoeducation? Is it like pulling it apart for the, how do you do that?
Yeah, you know what? It is a lot of psychoeducation at the outset, and to collaboratively with the client, pick apart what's this, what's that, what was there first, how does it. I'm a big fan of kind of mapping out cycles, so and triggers and where it goes and how it ends. And often we'll see the different, okay, when you do this, the panic happens. When the panic happens, the craving happens. When the craving happens, this happens. And so it's a lot of technically mapping it out, getting to know both of those parts, if we use an IFS lens, how they work, what their purpose is, and how they would interact with each other. And doing it, I'm exploring, the client's learning. It's a very collaborative, exploratory process of just what's going on here, right? I often, so I can't diagnose or prescribe, but I often will support the client in bringing in a medical professional, their family doctor. Sometimes they're interested in seeing a psychiatrist because when we are dealing with, let's say, specifically mood and anxiety disorders, medication can sometimes play a very important role. Same with recovery from certain substances, right? So we'll often discuss a support plan that involves other professionals. And then we do a plan for symptom reduction, symptom management on the surface level, while also doing kind of the deeper work of IFS and exploring what's underneath all of this.
What is that symptom plan and symptom management?
It's different for everybody, but just in, let's say, in the case of someone with an eating disorder, we'd be looking at what is happening most often and why. The exploration and identification of, again, like that trigger and the cycle, and trying to interrupt that cycle. So, in that way, especially with, let's say, behavioral addictions, I'm a big fan of DBT skills, wedge those in there somewhere in the cycle, because sometimes it really is.
DBT is just for our listeners who don't know the acronym,
Right. Sorry.
is
Yes.
dialectical
Dialectical
behavior.
behavior therapy. Yes. And I'm trained in DBT. It's not my primary modality, but I cannot like sing the praises enough of some of those distress tolerance skills, because when you are engaging in a repetitive compulsive behavior or addictive behavior, whether it be using substances or eating disorders or any other sort of harmful or unhealthy coping strategy, and you stop doing that, or you even think about stop doing that, there is distress. So the DBT skills assist with coping with some of that distress and allowing some space to make a new choice. So that's how we would kind of deal with symptom interruption in terms of the addiction. And then with the concurrent mental health issue, we do that alongside. Sometimes it's the same strategies for symptom interruption. And symptom coping, and sometimes it's different strategies. Right. So with anxiety, I do lots of kind of skills around acceptance and commitment therapy, sometimes cognitive behavior therapy if they seem that they fit. And that's what's in our plan, kind of surface level plan, and we would practice using those things for the person in the moment. And kind of in my sessions, it would be framed deeper in where did this come from? What's the underlying emotional and cognitive processes? And usually that is through IFS.
Would you approach it the same way if anxiety is manifesting into panic attacks? Like, I'm assuming that panic attacks and substance cravings can intersect at times. So if there's cravings happen, then the anxiety ramps up. And would you treat that in the same way?
So in that situation, it would depend on kind of the client's story and what their experience was. But as you framed it in that way and what I'm imagining, I think the panic attack would take precedence, right? Because the anxiety, the craving can probably create kind of the kindling for that panic response. But the panic response is very physiological, right? It's maintained by what's going on in the mind, but it's a very physical experience. So I'd probably work primarily on how to manage and ride the wave of that panic attack and create kind of openings for other ways of coping with that aside from just using the substance. So I think that would be like a two-in-one situation where we talk about both kind of strategies and
Both. And so what about social anxiety? Does that, like, how does that specifically affect recovery from substance use disorders? I'm imagining in my mind, like, someone wanting to go to a 12-step program, and they have social anxiety disorder. What do you do in that case?
Girl, that happened to me 2 weeks ago.
It's
Did I was
so
like,
hard.
yeah, I went to an AA meeting and I was just like, what if people look at me and what if this? And my social anxiety was kicked up.
It's social anxiety is so, I've experienced it. I've lived it. It comes up still sometimes. It's brutal, right? It's because the solution often, or part of kind of the wellness and recovery plan, is really connection with others and getting out there and having a support network. And then social anxiety just says, nope, you're not doing that, which can create like we're stuck at home alone with our thoughts and a bunch of fear, and what makes sense, like substance use, right? So it's that cycle really feeds into each other. With social anxiety, I'm a big fan of, okay, so again, this the psychoeducation piece, the really understanding how anxiety works and what might be going on there. And I find that gives people a lot of power. They're like, oh, it's actually just this experience I'm having, again, with the parts work. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, this is one experience that I'm having. And there's also a part that has been through this so many times and knows I'm going to be okay and is willing and able to face that fear. And I would never say, okay, go to like the scariest place you can think of and speak for an hour. We approach it in that pyramid, kind of like, so okay, maybe your goal is to get to that AA meeting and shake a couple hands, and that feels like a level 10 scary, but what's like a level 1 scary, and let's start there, right? So maybe it's an online meeting, and you just build that resilience. Anxiety is, the more we do the scary thing and see that, hey, I'm okay, I did it, the smaller anxiety gets. The more we listen to anxiety and say, yeah, you're right, that is terrifying, I'm not going to do it, you know, eventually we get kind of stuck.
The worse
in this
it
box.
Gets.
Yeah.
Yeah. Someone very, very close to me was just diagnosed with social anxiety disorder. And, you know, there was that discussion of, unfortunately, it's not like you have to have repeated exposure to that anxiety and to build it up. And it's not about hiding away, especially with social anxiety disorder. It's not about hiding away. It's about becoming familiar and doing it repetitively again and again for it to lessen.
So for me, you go to your first AA meeting and you're like, this would be so much easier if we could have a drink. And so it's hard when you've used that as your coping mechanism for social anxiety, for me, for as long as I can remember.
It is, and that's where the complexity of a concurrent disorder comes in, right? So someone with just social anxiety, we might be able to say, okay, here's your exposure pyramid plan and some strategies and coping skills. And then you add in someone who's learned to cope through substance use, and it does become a little bit more complex. Right. And so it's about trigger management, support plan, and figuring out how to cope with cravings at the same time as coping with that anxiety.
And I think I was actually just listening to acceptance and commitment therapy book this morning, because that's a modality I practice. And they were talking about how having those coping strategies through cravings, and your anxiety is going to heighten. It's going to be more at the beginning, but so short term, it's going to feel harder. But the long term is what you want, right? Like, is what you want to get to. And it's almost like that piece, once you're aware, so if you can say to your client, or if someone knows, okay, my anxiety might feel worse in this moment, but it's going to get better. Even just knowing that is so helpful.
Yeah, exactly. And I often will kind of in session kind of laugh and just be like, oh my gosh, about the paradox of working with anxiety or other mental health issues too, is sometimes you just have to sit in the it's going to get really loud in the beginning. It's going to get really loud. And if you can ride that wave, practice that urge surfing and that distress tolerance and just what you can do in that moment when the wave is really high, and to Sonia's point earlier, get to the other side of that, and it usually doesn't last as long as we think it will. That's where resilience is. That is where healing is. It's if it hurts, you're doing the work for the most part. In the right context. If it's uncomfortable and you're doing the thing, the next right thing, and it's uncomfortable, getting through it is a new level of being. It's a new level of resilience.
Did you know your actual age might not be the same as your biological age? That's right. It's not just about your birth date. Your body could be older or younger than you think. That's where True Diagnostic comes in. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part? It's all done from the comfort of your own home. No prescriptions, no lab visits, just a simple test sent right to your door. By tracking your biological age, you can actually see how the changes you make, whether it's to your exercise, diet, or sleep, affect your health over time. It's about taking actionable steps to improve your well-being. Oh, and if you are wondering about high-profile people taking it seriously, Brian Johnson, the guy who's working on reversing aging, and I watched his documentary on Netflix, uses True Diagnostic to track his progress. Ready to find out your biological age? Right now, our listeners can get 20% off their entire order at truediagnostic.com by using the code CIS2025 at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, TRUDIAGNOSTIC.com. Just use the code SIS2025 to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think we're going to switch gears a little bit to depression, another hot topic.
Yay! I got that too. Yeah.
I do not, actually. Luckily, I don't. But how do you differentiate between symptoms of depression and those of substance use disorder when they co-occur? I often think, is it chicken or egg? Which one is the one that comes first? Is it the depression that causes the substance use? Is the substance use that causes depression?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, to be honest, there's no, even in the literature and the research, like, no one really knows. And what we know, our best guess, and what we've seen in various kind of areas of psychology, is that everything is kind of multifactorial and will be a mix of a bi-directional kind of activities. In anecdotal experience, oftentimes, what we were talking about before, if you do a solid history and go back and ask people about their experience early on before substance use existed, or was the main coping strategy, you'll usually find some, maybe not kind of diagnostic level, but you usually find some of those symptoms pre-existing before substance use or before addiction develops, and usually a worsening after the addiction starts, right? Especially, so one thing that would interest me when I'm working with clients and picking apart where different things might have come from is like what substance they're using, because a few of them are depressants, right? So alcohol, opiates can mimic kind of depression or symptoms of depression too. So that would be interesting to know, whereas other ones like stimulants or amphetamines would not necessarily mimic symptoms of depression while using, but absolutely would in periods of withdrawal. So it'd be interesting to know those interactions and what the history of use is. And then again, like the period of abstinence, are those symptoms of depression worse? Are they better after a period of not using? Sometimes we'll see people fall into a bit of a depression in sobriety, which is like, oh, so hard. I want to have that not happen for people. It's just kind of like a kick in the butt when you're already working so hard for recovery.
You mentioned about sobriety, and I really felt the empathy you have for clients. Like, you just wish it wasn't so, like, in terms of when they get sober, their like depression can happen. Do you think that untreated depression can contribute to the risk of relapse?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, untreated depression is just a really hard place to be, right? Because the mind has a really hard time remembering anything good and a really easy time focusing on all the bad. And it's a disconnector, right? Depression is a disconnector. And what we know about recovery from addiction is that we need connection. So it absolutely does contribute.
I mean, I can't remember a time I wanted to drink more in my sobriety than when I was going through my divorce. Like, I remember sitting there just being like, there's no other way to deal with this other than to drink. I mean, I didn't, but it was really, really, really hard. So I can totally see how it contributes to relapse. And I wasn't, that wasn't even untreated depression, girl. That was treated. Like I had like medication and a therapist, and I still wanted to drink. And Kathleen.
Okay. On like speed dial. Yes.
Yeah.
24/7.
Yeah. And I still wanted to be like, oh, a glass of wine would be really good right now. Okay. So what approaches do you find most effective, Erin, when you're dealing with clients with co-occurring depression and substance use?
Yeah. Co-occurring depression, substance use is a tricky one. Like I have a lot of respect for people. I think with depression, it's like, oh yeah, depression, everybody has depression. It's very much in the media. It's, but the true experience of depression or major depression is such a deep, like I just have so much empathy. It's such a challenge because you cannot see the light at the end of the tunnel. Part of my role is holding space for the light at the end of the tunnel when the person can't see it. I find that psychoeducation around the process of depression, saying this isn't how, who you are, this is what depression shows up like. Maybe it's a symptom, maybe it's a part and not who you are. So the psychoeducation piece, and truly, if we're thinking practical, so kind of notwithstanding any of the therapeutic interventions or like what would happen in our sessions, which would probably be deeper parts work, et cetera, the practical stuff would be, how do we connect you to someone or something? Because what we know, what I've said before about depression, is it's an isolator, it's a hope killer. So how do we connect you with the activities of daily living, some support system that can help hold you together, hold you in place, help you see a little bit of that light at the end of the tunnel while this happens? And again, like bringing in medical professionals if the depression is untreated.
Sonia, I want to, you can edit this out, but I wanted to just chat about something you do, because I know you struggle with depression, Sonia. And one of the things I think you're so good at doing is, I obviously am not a proponent of a snap out of it thing, because that's not at all what I believe. But Sonia, you, when you are going through a depressive episode, you are very much are so good at like, what is the one thing I can do today? Do I shower? Yeah. Do I go for a walk? Do I work out? Even if you don't want to, you just do it. Like you just force yourself to do that one thing. And I think that's been a really effective strategy for you, right?
Yeah, usually if my depression's not that bad, usually doing the one thing will lead to doing another thing. Not always, you know, sometimes I do the one thing and then I get back on the couch and watch Netflix. But most of the time, yeah, for sure. But I always think that's taken so many years to figure out. I can't believe that took me 30 years to figure that out. And so I really empathize with people who struggle with both. Because if you're not also getting the right therapy and your medications right, it's really hard. It's easy for me now to be like, well, let's just do one thing. But it wasn't always that easy.
Yeah. And it's, I am not so much of a depression girly. I'm more of an anxiety lady. But I have had a couple experiences of short, thankfully, periods of depression, definitely before, but definitely since my recovery, which has been around 11 years now. And I'm so humbled by the experience of like, wow, it's hard to brush my teeth right now. I do not have it in me to brush my teeth right now. I would then do it anyways, which I understand some people don't have the capacity to do that, but it just gave me so much of an understanding of like, there's a phrase I've heard spoken about in different therapeutic trainings, and you can't ask a fish to climb a tree, right? And so it helps me understand that when I'm working with clients who are in intense periods of depression, I'm not going to say, okay, here's your 10-point plan, or let's really go deep into your childhood right now. It really is sometimes just about the very practical skills of let's find an anchor to hold on to right now and do what seems like maybe a small thing to them, maybe a small thing to the rest of society, but it's actually a huge thing. Like you were saying, Sonia, is like the one thing. because that is a monumental task, right? And you couple that with recovering from an addiction, and it becomes very important to do that one thing. And usually it would be something for your recovery and then maybe something for your physical well-being. And if that's all you do in a day, that's okay.
Yeah,
the next right thing.
Yeah, I think what's interesting too, and that is me medicated, right? And so that actually leads me to the next question, and is how important is medication management in treating clients with co-occurring depression or depression in general?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of use the tools that are available, right? So definitely there's some people that say, I don't want medication, and that's up to them, and it's okay for them. There are some people that I work with where it's very clear to me that they think it's a chemical imbalance. Like, that's how that's coming across, right? And they're very open to talking about that with their doctor and working with their doctor. And as the person has a good doctor that's knowledgeable and understanding, I've seen huge differences when people have their medication managed properly. I think it's really important. It's not for everybody, but I'm a big fan of using the tools that are available and using what works, and definitely a big proponent of a medication when it feels right for the client and when it's helpful.
That's nice. So Kathleen was here last week and we had a lot of conversations about the chemical imbalance. And so obviously like my family history, so that means Kathleen's ex and the children involved, do they have a predisposition? And do you give people essentially a pass because there's a chemical imbalance? Or do you give yourself a pass? Do you say, you know what, this is a chemical imbalance, I'm going to sit here and watch Netflix all day? And so, yeah, we talked about that a lot last week.
We did. I mean, there isn't going to be a right answer, but our viewpoint was, I think the knowledge is power. So like knowing there is a genetic component potentially. Mm-hmm. So meaning that maybe you have extra strategies in place. Yes. Maybe you are more aware of it. So knowing that there is that component, you pay more attention to it. So, you know, I can't just like let chance happen. Like I really have to have those tools and strategies on a consistent basis in my life.
Yeah, absolutely. And substance use is creating a chemical imbalance.
Right. Yes.
There's
Good
that
point.
Piece too. When we think about the concurring together, and one will exacerbate the other, or what we know about kind of epigenetics and life experiences is like that predisposition could be there, and then engaging in certain behaviors or substance use or having something happen to us will like flip those switches on. There's the addiction or there's the depression.
That's how I look at it, is that it's, yeah, okay, there's a chemical imbalance that gets, it's triggered, right? It's a combination of genetics and the situation that triggers it.
Yeah, absolutely. And in that vein, we will see too, people who will use substances for long enough that there will be a resulting chemical imbalance that remains to some degree needs to be treated after if they do stop using substances. And there's some sensitization that happens in the brain structures and chemicals that, so in a very intense example, people who use crystal meth for a very long time may have long-term delusions, long-term paranoia. People who use alcohol for a very long time may have brain impairment that leads to symptoms of depression or anxiety for a very long time. So it's kind of like the intense end of the spectrum, the more extreme, but
Girl, I dated this guy in college who did too much MDMA, and he had major issues after. Actually with really serious depression when he had never been depressed before.
And I will stop myself from going into like the nerd out neurochemical explanation of that, but that makes perfect sense, right? And it's humbling to recognize like sometimes the solution, the thing that feels good, can
make it way worse or cause. Yeah. Well, yeah, I realized you didn't want to say create or cause, but it's true. It can really, really contribute to that. So we wanted to shift a little bit to another topic, which is eating disorders. And I know you have expertise in this area. This is a topic that is very near and dear to my heart, not because I treat eating disorders. I do not, but I myself am in recovery from eating disorder quite substantially when I was a teenager with anorexia and bulimia. Mm-hmm. And then interestingly, it shifted to binge eating disorder in my mm-hmm. later years, which is apparently common.
Yeah, it does do that. Yeah.
It does, that sneaky little sucker. It does do that. Yeah, yeah. So we wanted to talk about eating disorders. How common are eating disorders with substance use disorder, and why is this combination challenging?
Yeah, so like with the concurrent disorders in general, it's hard to pin down specifically right. what the number is. I have my own experience kind of anecdotally, but I would say like the ballpark is anywhere between 20 and 50% for eating disorders. And anecdotally, it's so common, mm-hmm. especially we find lots of men are being diagnosed with eating disorders now. For a very long time, it was kind of women primarily. But so I'm just thinking back to my time working in the inpatient treatment unit, and so many of those clients, I would say probably a third of them, had concurrent eating disorder issues. And the process that I would typically see is sometimes both addiction and eating disorders would be very active at the same time. But what we typically see is while the substance use is active, the eating disorder is less active. And then once recovery happened from the substance use, the eating disorder popped back up really strong yeah. again, which was my experience.
Yeah.
Right. So while I was actively using substances, I was, I don't know, the eating disorders in the corner waiting. And then when I put down all the drugs and alcohol, the eating disorder was like, here I am. Right. So mm-hmm. I see that quite often. It's very common.
So how do you approach the treatment of a client who has both an eating disorder and a substance use disorder? And from what you're saying, when you treat one, the other one kind of has space to mm-hmm. grow.
Yeah, so in my approach, we do a lot of kind of what I spoke about before, identification, like what are the different processes at play here? I'm trained in CBTE. It's not my main modality because I tend to not be very good at sticking in the box of CBT and mm-hmm. do a lot of IFS and eating disorder treatment too. But the one thing that's helpful about CBTE, which is CBT for eating disorders, is this idea of maintaining factors, right? So that every eating disorder will have factors that maintain it. And I find that to be true of addictions too. So we do a lot of work at the forefront of therapy of like, what is showing up to maintain these behaviors? What are the core beliefs underneath them? What's going on? I view eating disorders and addictions as symptoms or our best attempt to cope with a pain that is within us. So what is that pain? What purpose are these two things serving? And IFS is super helpful for that because you get into the different like parts of why usually it's a protector in some way. So a lot of work around that in the forefront. Sometimes eating disorder work can't happen unless the substance use has slowed down a little bit. So I'm never a person who says you need abstinence unless that's the client's goal. But sometimes regular intoxication to the point of not really being able to show up in therapy and get into that deeper level will prevent eating disorder treatment from happening. And sometimes you have to deal with the symptoms that are the most harmful first. So sometimes mm-hmm. that's eating disorder symptoms, sometimes that's substance use symptoms.
How do body image issues and self-esteem challenges affect the recovery process from, well, substance yeah. use and eating disorders?
Oh, it's a big one. Body image yeah. challenges are so deeply ingrained as a sense, a source of toxic shame and self-hatred for people that it's really stuck in there, right, mm-hmm. for a lot of people. And I don't know if you guys have had this experience, but where like a bad body day or feeling a sense of shame or unhappiness with the body can truly impact your mood for the rest of the day.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's big. That's big for the clients that I work with. And again, sometimes it's that stress tolerance. It's like, how do we cope with that? We can't always run from it. We want it to be different and that takes time. But sometimes it's like, okay, you're having like a really big shame flare up because of this body image experience that you're having. And how do we cope with that without engaging in harmful behaviors, right? When I do eating disorder work, do a lot of psychoeducation and diet culture and just like the big lie that we're all being sold. And I love to see my clients get like a little bit angry about that, right? Mm-hmm. A little bit angry about that that lie that we're being sold and the idea that our bodies are equal our worth. So there's a lot of that work and opening the lens and challenging the paradigm a little bit. But yeah, I feel like I'm going on. So I'm going to stop now.
No, that's really enjoyed that. So there's this idea that like eating disorders are about control. And so how does that play into this kind of co-occurring disorder idea with substance use and an eating disorder?
Yeah, I find like if we, one of the frameworks I sometimes use are just like an image with my clients is like this idea of a tree, right? So the roots are, something's there, the roots, and maybe the wound, the trauma, the pain, whatever might be going on, that's the roots. And then it'll grow and into these different branches, right? And they're different manifestations of kind of the same challenge or same concern. And I don't know if there's any like research backing that, but it's just what makes sense to me. And it seems to fit well with my clients. And some of those branches can be substance use, so addiction and eating disorder. And we can trace it back to the same place and realize that both of those behaviors, as well as other ones that show up, are serving a very similar purpose, right? So the coping and in your kind of, to your point, control. I find like some eating disorder presentations are about control, and I think some are not about losing control, about breaking free, about having, being messy for once in their life. And then especially kind of bulimia and binge eating disorder, if we break that into kind of like a parts lens, which I love to do, like the part that wants to eat or binge is like the F it part. I'm going to do what I want for once in my day. I'm going to do what I want because I'm always so strict and I'm always so perfect. And the pressure of perfection is like so intense and pressure of restriction is so intense that eating part comes in kind of a really beautiful energy, not a beautiful manifestation, but of saying like, no, you're going to do what you want for once. Right. So it is about control. And then it's also about that backlash against control as well.
Mm-hmm. What about food addiction? Is that the same thing as an eating disorder or is that a substance use? Like, how would you categorize that? How do you know the difference?
That's tricky. I don't know how much I believe that food can be an addiction. Right? Like I think addiction is, it can mimic and it can meet a lot of the diagnostic criteria of addiction. And if we look at it on a biochemical level, it does activate the same parts in the brain. But that's one where I'll say I don't 100% know. The treatment center that I worked in had a food addiction pilot program. And so at that time, I was really like, yes, food addiction, it made a lot of sense to me. But the more training and work I've done in trauma and eating disorders and the manifestation of that, I wonder if food addiction isn't also just a form of disordered eating that is kind of deeper than the chemical process of dependence on substances. So that's a tricky one. Some people find the concept of food addiction really helpful and will engage in supports based on the idea of food addiction. And if that works for them, I love that for them. Right.
Also am not sure, Erin. I'm undecided on that. I go back and forth depending on what research I'm reading. And I think it is a tricky one because you can have that biochemical reaction, like the dopamine from eating sugar or like high carbohydrate foods, but it's a tricky thing. Yeah. Is it an addiction or is it an eating disorder? But does it matter in a sense of what it is if you can treat it in a similar way, I guess? I don't know. Like maybe it doesn't matter what the category is.
I think it matters. Like some people have a very strong foundation in 12-step recovery or a specific kind of addiction focused recovery that works really well for them. So slotting any kind of disordered eating or like a concept of food addiction into that 12-step mold is exactly what they need and exactly what works for them. So like, great. I'm never going to find problem with that. I think if I'm going to sit back and say what my concern with food addiction would be is that the solution is, in some circles, would be some form of restriction. And saying, for sure. Okay, this is a trigger food, so don't have the trigger food. And that a little bit, a lot, goes against kind of my general framework for understanding that restriction contributes to the maintenance of disordered eating. And yes. also restriction is not that place of body love and trust that we want to get to. So it's, I think personally, that's where it deviates from my framework, but I think it works well for a lot of people. So whatever works.
And so, okay, you talked a little bit about if someone has an eating disorder and then they're also addressing their substance use, you're looking at, okay, which do you need to address first? So if someone has a substance use disorder and an eating disorder, are you even looking at their relationship with food at that point and how to have a healthy relationship with food, or are you just focusing on the substance use?
It depends on the client. It depends on what their most distressing concern is, right? So some people will, there's a primary and a secondary. They are concurrent.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're like this, but usually there's one that's more active than the other. And that the client knows what that is. If there is someone who is at an extremely low weight and physically, or at an extreme end of the spectrum to the point that their physical well-being and their safety is at risk, that would then probably, for me, take some sort of precedence. That being said, if a client is just in Rose psychotherapy practice, if a client is in a medical emergency, I would support them in finding other supports that are more intensive than what I can offer. But that would be the eating disorder showing up first. If there's, like I said before, the intoxication is very prevalent, then that would show up first. But it really is what's distressing the client the most, and finding out the interplay. Okay, so maybe you drink instead of eating. How can we deal with both of those things, right, at the same time? Like, what's a plan around that? It can be challenging. And then sometimes if the addiction is more precedent, we just think, how do we keep your body as healthy as possible right now while we cope with the addiction, while we work with the addiction? Integrated treatment and concurrent treatment has the best outcome. So we try as best as possible to work with both sets of symptoms and disorder, don't like that word, challenges at the same time.
Well, thank you so much, Erin. Like, you've been such a wealth of information, and I'm so happy that you agreed to come on a second time. Do you have any final advice that you can give our listeners who may be struggling with co-occurring disorders, or even supporting someone who is?
Yeah. I think so much compassion and empathy for themselves, right? So it can feel pretty daunting, probably, even listening to some of the things that we've spoken about, or some of the things that are on other sources of media, to feel like, oh my gosh, I have two or three things that I have to recover from. That feels really daunting, and it feels really like I can't do it. But just the relationship between substance use issues and mental health issues can work together to make things harder. The recovery can work together to make things easier, and it's possible. Like, recovery is possible, and the interactions can go in the positive direction too, right? And I think to have compassion for where you are on the journey and know that support is available. And if someone is struggling in their lives and wanting to support that person, again, compassion and empathy, but always self-care for the caregiver as well.
That's an important point. Self-care for the caregiver.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to Sisters in Sobriety, and we will see you next week.
This was Sisters in Sobriety.
Thank you for listening and being with us today.
If you want to learn more about sobriety and meet your community, find us at sistersinsobriety.substack.com.
Are you a sister in sobriety? Then reach out on social media. We'd love to hear from you.
If you're feeling generous, leave us 5 stars and a review, and follow us wherever you listen.
You'll never miss an episode. Until next time.